The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, today live coming to you from Campbell Hall in beautiful downtown, or not downtown, suburban Urbana, I don't know, outskirts Urbana in east central Illinois on a lovely, lovely winter day. Today we've got a really great show, I think. Joining us from her apartment in New York City is our guest today, Laura Flanders. Laura Flanders is the host of Working Assets Radio, a daily progressive call-in program heard on public radio in San Francisco. She does it out of New York, though. She writes a weekly column for TomPaine.com and frequently contributes to other online publications such as Common Dreams, ZNet, and the Media Channel. She's also the author of the excellent book, Real Majority, Media Minority, The Cost of Sidelining Women in Reporting. Laura, are you there?
I'm here.
I want to thank you so much for taking time off of your Sunday afternoon and your Super Bowl preparations.
It's all right. My guacamole is already made. I'm ready to go.
All right. Excellent. And joining us today. And I should also add, you worked for, is it 10 years for Fairness and Accuracy?
I did. 10 years. And that's where we first met, I think.
That's right. And you started the women's desk at Fair, which is now an institution there.
You're right.
And you were the co-host of the radio show.
That's right.
All right. So I think a lot of our listeners...
130 stations all over the country.
Yeah, a lot of our listeners are familiar with you and your writings and your radio work. Now, Working Assets Radio is something you don't have to live in San Francisco to hear this, do you?
Isn't that cool? No, you can listen to it in San Francisco on the radio, but you can hear it anyplace else on the internet. And we have increasing numbers of callers and listeners, apparently, online from all over the country.
And the radio show is basically a public affairs show. It deals with all sorts of issues, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, we deal with public affairs and culture. We bring into the studio sort of newsmakers and artists and activists. And what's really a departure for me that I'm so excited about is that, like your show, Bob, it's a call-in show. So I feel that we put out a lot of information in the alternative media, in the not-for-profit media. We put out a huge amount of research and data and analysis and punditry to try to balance what we don't get elsewhere. The one thing we've lacked, I think, historically, has been any place for progressive people to chew over what they're hearing, to try out their arguments, to discuss differences with one another, and to really hone their ideas and their thinking. So a call-in show is ideal for that. It's all about putting out a question. What's the question of the day, and what do we think, and how do we talk about it, and how do we, heaven forbid, talk with people with whom we disagree?
You know, I'll have a caller or two, I suspect, who will call in. If not, I'll speak for them if they're not near their phones today. They would say, but wait a second, Laura Flanders, the media are all a bunch of liberals anyway. Don't you have that already with liberals sort of chewing the fat on their government schemes to run people's lives?
Sure, surely your callers, Bob, would not say such a thing.
Well, one or two of them might.
They've listened to your critiques for years about how the spectrum of debate in the for-profit media goes sort of from the right to the far right, how we are occasionally permitted to see a debate from between the center and the right, but very rarely do you ever hear really progressive perspectives brought in. And I think this last week has been an interesting case in point. Not to change the topic completely, but...
Go right ahead.
If you look at the coverage of the protest in the last year, the last week, in the anti-war protest in the news, I feel as if we saw a bit of an improvement in the last week. We finally saw not just relatively respectful coverage of the big demonstrations in Washington and San Francisco, and I should say that this weekend has seen more demonstrations in Pittsburgh and Minneapolis, but just to focus last weekend on the 25th for a moment, there were major demonstrations in Washington and San Francisco that got coverage even in advance from some of the for-profit press and a big show on Nightline, for example, on the Thursday night on ABC before the 25th. And finally, when the demonstrations happened, there was fairly creditable coverage, I'd say. Washington Post ran a big picture on a front page and a double-page spread inside the A section, not all of it disdainful, talking about the breadth of the movement. So, okay, the media have discovered that there are anti-war voices out there, incredible ones, people that represent trade unions and church groups. Do they invite them into the studio in the week that follows then to discuss the war? No. The only place I saw anti-war activists brought into any studio was National Public Radio. In fact, Fresh Air, Terry Gross, brought in different representatives of those who had helped to organize the demonstrations on the 25th to discuss policy in Iraq. No, to discuss their own policy and their infighting inside the anti-war movement. So I think you have a great example of how a constituency can be on the radar screen, can show up after a lot of work, be paid attention to as long as it remains in the field, as long as it remains what we used to talk about at FAIR as sort of the stuff of wildlife coverage, National Geographic specials of protesters. The protesters are never allowed out of the protest into the places where policy is actually discussed, and I think that we've been much the poorer for it this week in particular.
You know, I wonder how much of the more balanced and temperate coverage of protesters, or even sympathetic coverage of protesters, is a reflection of journalists sort of wising up or getting do their job better, and how much is merely a reflection. There are significant elements of the political class and the economic elite in the United States who are horrified by the prospect of a war in Iraq, and this sort of billows over in the newsrooms, the sense that, yeah, maybe we should be asking some questions about this war.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, what we're seeing is nothing different from the usual, you know, same old story, in that most of our news coverage is still driven by what's happening in Washington. And it's only because there are differences of opinion, even among the elites in Washington, D.C., that we're getting as much discussion about the pros and cons of the Bush-Iraqi policy as we're seeing. A very interesting article. I mean, again, to talk about this last week, you had what I've just pointed out, the absence of the protesters being brought into the news coverage, except for when the topic was the protest. What you had, on the other hand, though, was a lot of inside the Beltway coverage, some of it actually revealing some interesting stuff. I mean, there are pros and cons to reporters being so embedded inside the Washington, you know, Beltway area. Judith Miller, not anybody I'm a huge fan of typically, but writing in the New York Times, wrote a piece about how Iraqi defectors were helping the Bush administration formulate Iraq policy. And if you had only read the headline, you would have thought that was all there was in the story. Defectors bolster U.S. case against Iraq, officials say. But if you read the actual text, what she reported on was a grave debate going on between those in the CIA and those in the Defense Department. As you probably remember, Donald Rumsfeld has developed his own intelligence division inside the Defense Department that he can control because he wasn't happy with the intelligence coming out of the CIA, the intelligence that couldn't cement a connection between the Iraqis and the attacks of September 11th, the intelligence that just wasn't coming up with the goods that he needed to fuel the Bush war plan. Well, Judith Miller, it's inside the Beltway reporting for sure, but she captures a major difference of opinion inside the administration, where the CIA is saying the defectors who are in giving intelligence to the Defense Department, there are only a handful who have any credibility in our view at all. And at the same time, the Defense Department folks working under Donald Rumsfeld way more willing to accept these defectors as credible. That's an interesting division of opinion and one that certainly deserves more attention.
Yeah, in fact, along those lines, I saw another piece from an Inside the Beltway sort of trade publications for people in politics, a very mainstream publication, but obscure to the general public, in which there was a similar article about how in the CIA and the FBI both, they're under spectacular pressure to come up with evidence to support the administration's position and discount anything that might go against it. I mean, they feel like they're being politicized in a way they haven't been before to sort of warp their work to support a particular war policy.
Yeah, well, and that's true in medical research, too. That's been a story that's appeared here and there. The LA Times ran a good piece about a month ago about how people on medical panels were being politically vetted for their views on things like RU486 and the connections between breast cancer and abortion, and the medical establishment's up in arms. So it's very interesting, Bob. I mean, you and I and the folks at FAIR and media activists around the country for a long time have talked about needing to get more voices from outside the establishment to be included in the mainstream debate. Now you have very establishment voices having to fight to get included inside the mainstream debate. It makes you wonder what that mainstream really is.
We're talking to Laura Flanders today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. If you'd like to call in and have a question or comment for Laura Flanders, the number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And Laura, before we go to the phone lines, let's talk a little bit about the George W. Bush administration and the press coverage of the Bush administration. We've already been talking about it. Let's do a direct hit. This morning, the New York Times Sunday Magazine had a cover story on the Bush administration, which argued basically that the Bush administration is in many ways the most radical conservative administration in American history. And really is going to make the Reagan administration, by comparison, look like a pretty moderate affair. What's your assessment of that position?
Well, I'm embarrassed to say you're ahead of me, even though I'm ahead of you in the time scale.
Yeah, I figured you'd get an hour
time
earlier.
Zones. I know, but I haven't read the article yet, but I'm glad to see it. It's absolutely true. And the shocking thing is, nothing we know now, and that the New York Times Magazine could be dedicating valuable pages to now, wasn't known in the year of 2000 of the presidential election campaign. There is not one revelation to have come out about who the Bush team is that wasn't already entirely public record, matter of public record in the year 2000. Is it good that the New York Times is suddenly waking up to this as a radical administration that intends to pick up on social and economic policy exactly where the Reagan administration left off? Yes. Is it shameful that they didn't write about that before, when the public really had a need to know back during the election campaign? Absolutely. I mean, you only have to look at this ridiculous debate about affirmative action this month, where you had, you know, reporters trying to make sense of what's the Bush administration position, when we know that the U.S. Solicitor General, the man who argued the case Bush v. Gore in front of the Supreme Court in 2000, this is a man who was the person that argued the case against Hopwood, or on behalf of Hopwood, in the against the University of Texas Law School in 1996. This is a man who is on the Civil Rights Committee of the Federalist Society, adamantly ideological, pro-states' rights, although they have an interesting definition of it, anti-civil rights, anti-federalist legal organization that is now in the position of challenging the American Bar Association for influence in Washington, that is now the legal association that briefs the incoming congresspeople and senators, along with the Heritage Foundation. Did we know this stuff before, who Ted Olson was, for example? Absolutely. We knew it in 2000. We know it now. The agenda of this crew deserves a lot of attention. I'm glad they're getting it, but it's too little too late.
So you think, if I understand you correctly, then, that the news media have really failed to present an accurate picture of the Bush administration or the Bush candidacy before the election?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's no book better to read, really, than Mark Crispin Miller's The Bush Dyslexicon. I mean, this is a book that, perhaps because of its title, didn't get all the attention it deserved when it came out, and it came out, unfortunately for it, in the fall of 2000.
I think it came out on September 10th.
Yeah, September 10th, right, 2001. So, it had its problems getting attention, but there's a book where Mark makes very clear that the press were taken in by Bush the buffoon, Bush the dork, Bush the guy who fumbles his words, and spent so much time making fun of the guy that they didn't pay attention to what he really was saying. When he would say things like, I believe in the value of life for the living and life for the unborn, people laughed. What they didn't hear was his message sending to those who really do believe in the rights of the unborn, as they call them, those who were out in the streets again this week protesting the legalization of abortion and the decision Roe versus Wade. Bush told us what he believed. Was he careful? Sure. But it was very clear. He sent messages not only with his appearance at Bob Jones University, which he made towards the beginning of his campaign, but the very last Sunday of his campaign was spent at a very similar religious education institution in Michigan, known as the Bob Jones University of that state, that also bars homosexuals, that also teaches that God's law is superior to man's law. Bush didn't rescind anything that he said at Bob Jones or didn't say around racism, segregation, or in South Carolina, the flying of the Confederate flag. The record was very clear. Was it taken seriously, brought to the public attention? No. I mean, in the summer of the election year, you have Planned Parenthood doing a survey, a poll of pro-choice Republicans, and finding that the majority of those thought Bush was on their side. The data, the facts couldn't have been clearer. The conveying of them, the communicating of them, couldn't have been muddier. And I think that we're paying a huge price for that now.
Now, had this been a Democratic president or candidate, do you think the coverage would have been similarly warped or distorted, or would there have been differences between the coverage of a Gore or a Clinton than the way George W. Bush was covered?
Well, I think that you saw it even in that race. I mean, you saw a press corps come down very hard on Al Gore for every error, in fact, that the guy made. And clearly, if you read some of the other books about the election campaign, Gore's handling of the press corps was very poorly done. They were in a bad mood, as far as I can see, for most of the time on the campaign trail, and felt treated poorly by the guy. They didn't feel any sense of discipline, which is to say, they, on the Bush campaign, from what I understand, were kept in incredible line. If you raised a critical question, you simply wouldn't get your question answered next time around. You would get a seat at the back of the bus, literally. In the Gore campaign, you saw the press come down very hard on every factual error, and of course there were many. That wasn't bad. What was bad was the failure to do the same for George W. Bush, and you saw that again in this last midterm, where the Republican candidates so muddied their position on Social Security and prescription benefits for the elderly, that people began to think that their positions were, in fact, the Democratic Party's positions. A huge confusion over just where the Republican Party stood on health insurance and the elderly and Social Security. Again, all a question of muddying what was, in fact, a pretty clear agenda, which you can find, anyone can find if you go to the Heritage Foundation website or if you ask for the actual legal briefs or bills as they're being prepared by the administration. It's not so hard to do. But if you're only going to follow the spin, and if you're only going to, you know, travel along in the campaign bus, you're going to probably miss half the facts, because that's the idea.
When I talk to journalists and I raise this issue you just raised, to make this point and ask them to, about that, sometimes what they'll say is, look, you know, the Democrats are the ones who have to make these charges. If they're not pushing it, we have nothing to work with. And the Democrats are the ones who've laid down. The Republicans play hardball with Al Gore, with their opponents, and they give us a lot to work with to write about. The Democrats play softball. We don't have much to work with, so we end up sounding like Republicans.
Well, what do you think about that, Bob? I mean, I hear that too on my show, and I can understand in a sense. On the other hand, if they would only agree to be moved by some other voices other than elected politicians, I don't think they'd have that problem. I mean, there isn't an organization in Washington that represents a progressive cause, whether you're talking Americans for the Separation of Church and State, People for the American Way, the ACLU, you know, Americans for a Fair Chance, the Pro-Affirmative Action Group, that hasn't got really clear critique of the administration, and that doesn't have a very hard time getting themselves quoted in the press, let alone getting their critique to spark a story. Are the reporters in need of Democratic politicians? We're all in need of a vigorous opponent, you know, opposition in Washington. But the press have a lot of other options. It's just that they seem to think they can only drive a story if it's being initiated by you know, anointed, accepted opposition, namely the opposition party.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the justification and to some extent the explanation, and it certainly leads us to the problems that you're outlining. We're talking to Laura Flanders today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We do have phone lines open if you'd like to call in. The number 333-9455 is the local number, our toll-free number, 1-800-222 9455. And let me let you know, listeners, that our upcoming guest here on Media Matters next week, we will be speaking with Mark Cooper from back from Brazil to talk about the World Social Forum. The following week, we'll have Eric Alterman talking about the liberal media with his new book, What Liberal Media? And then the week after that, Norman Solomon will be on the air with us, much promised. We were going to have Norman last week, but unfortunately I was caught down with flu, so we couldn't. And Norman will be talking about the war in Iraq. He has made two trips there now in the past few months and is very much up to speed on events in the ground in Iraq. So he'll give us some breaking coverage of that. And then we have many more shows on tap, so please stay tuned to Media Matters. If you'd like to find out more about Media Matters, what you can do is get our weekly email update on upcoming shows with links to our guest websites, articles, talks, and way to feedback and give us your input on the show. And to find out how to do this, to get on our weekly list, all you have to do is go to my personal website, robertmcchesney.com, www.robertmcchesney.com. And there'll be a link right on the homepage you can click and sign up and get the weekly emails. We won't use it commercially. Don't worry. We won't send lists to telemarketers or anything. And you can get off at any point if you don't want your weekly message. So we're here with Laura, and we've got a phone call for you right now. Line one, you're on the air with Laura Flanders.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a serious problem with the analysis that the Democrats played too soft. It seems to me that often it wasn't simply that they hopped, the media jumped on every misstatement that Al Gore made, but they often misquoted him. And I would cite the two most famous examples of this, that he claimed to have invented the Internet, and of course he didn't. What he said was he introduced legislation. He was the first member of Congress to bring it to the attention of Congress. And then there was also the claim that he had said that he had discovered the dump site in New York.
The dump site?
Yes.
Up in Buffalo.
Yes.
Yeah, I know.
Love Canal.
Love Canal.
Yes,
Love Canal. And of course, that wasn't what he said, that he had discovered this incident, but that he had introduced legislation again in Congress to deal with it. Both statements were factual. Both were misquoted.
So you'd like Laura to comment on that?
Yes.
Okie doke. We'll go ahead, Laura.
I mean, I think that the caller is right that there was both an alacrity to jump on the guy, but also a willingness to let stories coming out of the right-wing media become the conventional wisdom, whether they were accurate or not. I mean, the inventing the Internet story was originally seized on by all the same media activists on the right that had driven the Clinton-Monica Lewinsky story, all those Richard Scaife-funded American Spectator writers and others at the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere on the editorial page. There's that piece of this picture, too, and I'm glad the caller brings it out, that not only is there a lack of vigorous rhetoric coming out of the Democratic Party, but there is a very vigorous media machine funded by the right to push certain stories into the discourse such that they become accepted as true, whether they're true or not. And I think Gore was a victim of that. But I still believe that in this moment, for example, if there were Democrats providing a strong position on, what it would take to make this nation secure, an alternative Homeland Security proposal that talked about statewide budget deficits and the unemployed and the uninsured, that talked about poverty as a threat to social security, to our society's security, and environmental degradation as a threat to our safety now and in the future. If there was strong language coming out of the Democrats, I think that they would be less prey to these stories being fueled artificially coming out of the right, and could get something of an upper hand in this public debate. I do think there's a bit of both going on.
You know, Laura, you mentioned the conservative or right-wing media and sort of the attacks they make on Gore and Democratic politicians and how successful they've been. One of the striking areas where conservatives have had tremendous success politically has been on commercial talk radio, where I don't know the exact figures, but I'm willing to wager that the overwhelming majority of conservative talk radio in the United States is conducted by people who are explicitly partisan to the Bush administration, the Republican Party, highly partisan and extraordinarily hostile to views divergent from theirs, at least to their political left or to the center. Yet this country, in elections, is hardly, 90%, 10% right-wing, left, or right-center. Why do you think there's such a divergence between the range of opinion on talk radio and the viewpoints of the people in this country?
Oh, well, that's a very big question.
Well, we've got a half hour.
We have a half hour. I mean, I think there's something about the format itself and the traditions that build up. I mean, radio, as you know, is a very habitual medium. People listen basically to the same station, or they tend to, that they've listened to for the last 10 years. Sometimes the same station that their parents listened to, that they grew up listening to. So people have kind of radio habits, and the fact that talk radio is the kind of venue for right-wingers to sound off, I think, is in part habitual. It's also a matter of money, that we have a situation where we have, a very homogenized media fare, not only on television and in print, but on the radio too, so that when you launch a new talk show, for example, just think of one recent one, Bill O'Reilly's talk show, the radio version of his television show, his successful show on cable, you have a market of, I think it was 250 stations buying up on the first day, twice that within a month. Whether the show is successful or not, you can show to advertisers that there is this market that is buying the show all across the country. Advertisers like to have national reach, not local reach. And I think it's very hard for progressives to get that kind of a bang for the buck, very hard to attract the financial support for commercials. And that's just the way that, the same routine that we see, the same phenomenon that we see all across publicly, so-called publicly funded media, that there is, no match really in the nonprofit world for what sort of muscle there is in the for-profit world. And it's very, very hard for us to compete. On the other hand, I mean, this is another situation where, well, two things. I want to talk about the form a little bit. I mean, I do think that a Limbaugh show or a O'Reilly phenomenon where you have a guy basically railing doesn't lend itself all that well to progressive talk. Progressives tend to live more in the kind of critical thinking area. Is it this way? Is it that way? I give us credit that we're actually curious and less, at least, less prone to just put out a single line of ideological, propagandistic kind of position and hammer it day after day. Maybe it's the history of McCarthyism in this country, that people are scared to really claim an ideology on the left. But I do think that the right-wing model is uncomfortable for progressives, where we like to have more thinking and questioning than just kind of railing. On the other hand, going back to the Democrats for a minute, we had Donna Brazile, at one point Gore's campaign director, on our show a few weeks ago, and I was asking her about the news story that had broken at the beginning of January that the Democratic Party was trying to mobilize a media machine. Did you catch that, Bob?
Certainly.
And I said, now you were in power for 8 years. The Democrats held the White House for 8 years. Throughout that time, you didn't figure out how to support progressive media or even just media that would be open to your point of view. You did nothing to set such kind of mechanisms in place. You can be sure the right always use the White House to empower all sorts of networks, think tanks and so on, as well as media, to live on after their time in office. I said, you never did that in 8 years, and now you want to do it? They're just waking up to the problem now? She said, it's worse than that. She said, not only are they just now literally mapping the country for where progressive talk radio hosts, for example, might be on the air, who might be accessible to their message and be interested in interviewing them about their positions on policy, and we're just talking Democrats here, But they're only now trying to teach their campaign directors locally not to throw away their campaign mailing lists after the elections are finished. But on the Democratic side, the level of kind of internal organization is really deeply lacking. So that's, you know, I think that those of us who've been trying to get out a progressive message have not been being helped by the Democrats for a very, very long time.
We're talking to Laura Flanders today in Media Matters. We have a few people who have been very patient waiting to ask you a question, Laura. So let's go back to the phone lines and talk to them. Line two, Urbana, you're on the air with Laura Flanders.
Yes, I have a question for both of you, Laura and Bob. This week I heard comments by Donald Rumsfeld discounting the role of France and Germany in Europe, almost saying that we don't really need to give them much consideration or attention because they're relatively powerless. So I'm wondering, how is the media covering this old Europe, new Europe? And why does the Bush administration give articulation to this at a time they're trying to get France and Germany's support in the Security Council? I think I'll just hang up and listen to your conversation.
All right, well, thank you very much. Yeah, Laura?
Well, I think it's very interesting. I mean, the kind of coverage that there was this week of that, I mean, Donald Rumsfeld is clearly morphing into Secretary of Offense. First, it was the draftees, whom he said contributed really nothing to the value and power of the military. Now, our strongest European allies are being described and told that they're basically irrelevant. Was he saying something true in a sense? I guess, kind of. And we had a guy from Le Monde, the Washington bureau chief from Le Monde, on our show on Friday, who said, you know, there is an old Europe and a new Europe, and the Eastern Europeans do tend to be way more in line with American policy. Why? Because they're more vulnerable to and more dependent on European aid and assistance, and they give the U.S. They're more dependent on American aid and assistance.
Yeah.
And give the U.S. a lot of credit for having liberated them from communism and so on and so forth. So on one hand, Rumsfeld was saying something, sending a message, you know, that we do believe that there are, you know, there is a divide in Europe, and we do have a support base outside of Western Europe. On the other hand, I think one of the aspects of the war on Iraq preparations that have been deeply undercovered, and maybe this was part of it, was the power of the U.S. to intimidate nations around the world. We saw it back in 91 with Yemen, when that country voted against at the United Nations giving the U.S. the okay to go to war in the Gulf War, and was told by the U.N. ambassador on mic that would be the most expensive vote they ever cast. And sure enough, a day later, the entire aid budget for that country from the U.S. was cut. We now have African nations who are entirely dependent on, or very dependent on, U.S. aid coming from the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act passed under the Clinton administration, which has written into the law that no country that receives U.S. aid can act in a way that is contrary or counter to U.S. interests. So you have a lot of very intimidated nations out there, and I felt that there was something in what happened this week that was about threatening Germany and France. Whether that's just an indication of how arrogant the Bush administration is in believing it really doesn't need those critical allies, I don't know. But there is another piece of the picture, too, which is that France is one of the countries already in contract with Iraq with respect to oil production and control over oil resources. As I understand it, it's assumed that all those contracts will be null and void after an invasion. Maybe this is message sending to France that if it doesn't fall in line, they could find their oil contracts in trouble. But was it big news of the week? For sure.
We have a bank full of callers wanting to talk to Laura Flanders, and I want to get to all of you, so we'll make sure we will. Let's start right now. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Laura Flanders.
Hi, yes. I just want to iterate. I think the problem is that the left does not attack the right. I mean, here you got basically what you're saying is the media taking falsehoods and lies and running with them. You know, in any other country, that would become a bureau of propaganda. It wouldn't be a media. And yet the left is reacting like, well, you know, gee golly, they got a point of view, and we have to respect that. Meanwhile, the right, you know, gets Rush Limbaugh 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, really riling up people to feel about issues in a certain way. And I think this is what happens. And we sit here and be all intellectual and all we're fair and just. But meanwhile, since we don't have any attack dogs on our side, it doesn't invoke the feelings to motivate people to do something. When I first started listening to talk radio, they had the FCC fairness doctrine, which, you know, means if you had a right-wing host, you had to have a left-wing host. And it was very different back then. And, of course, 8 years of Clinton, of course, I wouldn't call Clinton a liberal at all, didn't address that issue and just led the media. So, with Democrats, half of them being, two-thirds of Democrats voted for Ashcroft, how can we expect them to have a progressive agenda and start progressive media, too? So, I probably just ranted with a bunch of things on my mind.
Well, you're totally right. I mean, we've been talking a little bit about sort of the presence of Democrats and Republicans in the media. The problem is we have too much of both of them and not enough of anybody else. I think Bob's point was that journalists tend to say, oh, it's not our fault because there are no Democratic politicians. They can't be allowed to get away with that any longer, I think, and we do have to hold them to account, as we have to hold Democratic politicians to account for helping this situation to perpetuate itself. And you're right to point out that the fairness doctrine, again, the Clinton administration had reaped the reward of its own lack of action on that, I think, as it saw talk radio be brought into power, brought into its own in the anti-Clinton campaign.
We're talking to Laura Flanders today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're going to get back to the phone lines in a second. We have an open line at 333-9455, and our toll-free number is still open at 1-800-222-9455. Laura, I just wanted to ask you, what media do you consume yourself on a daily basis or weekly basis to stay on top of issues, to sort of help you cut through what's being thrown at you?
Well, I would say I try to read three dailies, and it varies between sort of two large format and one tabloid paper. Or recently I've been reading actually the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times every day. The Wall Street Journal, if you ignore the editorial page, really has some excellent reporting, particularly on international affairs and some of the better reporting on the state of economic crisis in the States that you'll find anywhere. The Washington Post is very good on the sort of inside the administration divisions and ran a piece long before this Judith Miller piece in the Times about just how angry many members of the military were becoming with Donald Rumsfeld's high-handed and arrogant way of operating the Department of Defense. The Times is the Times. On the Internet, I tend to look at commondreams.org on a pretty daily basis. I'll take a look at BuzzFlash. I'll read the indie media sites as often as I can. Tom Paine, Mother Jones. I also find sites like Cursor.org are good. There's a large array, all of which are helpful, often because they signal to you where you can find, you know, more reporting on a certain subject. So you'll get hints as to what's appearing in The Guardian or the Indian newspapers. Or I also read the Egyptian paper, the weekly Al-Haram that comes out in English every week.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It really is an eye-opener for how U.S. policy is being viewed from the Arab world.
Well, my experience from, and this is one of the great privileges of the Internet, is having access to non-U.S. news media. You can get a very different view of the world very quickly. And one, you can go to Egypt or India or Japan to do it, but you can just look in Canadian and British media oftentimes and get a very different view as well.
And in terms of U.S. coverage, I mean, I do a radio show in San Francisco, so I forgot to mention I do read The Chronicle on a daily basis too. And, I mean, that paper is light, night and day from, for example, the New York Times covering sometimes the very same issue.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Laura Flanders. We've got a bank full of callers. Let's go to line 3, Champaign County. You're on the air with Laura Flanders.
Hi.
Thank you for your patience, by the way.
Oh, thank you for getting to me. I'll try to be brief. I'd love to rant, but I wanted to focus on this sort of inside and outside. I wanted to ask about the idea that Hightower was... there's a story there that I don't feel is told. He's cited as one of the people whose liberal experiment in talk radio didn't work. But my memory is that he was on a chain that was bought by Disney, and he was sort of summarily dismissed, even though his numbers were good enough to keep him on. So he's always cited as why, a populist doesn't make it on the air, but it actually was very blatantly a corporate decision that took him off. And then I'm hesitant to do this, but I guess I'm going to go ahead because Tony Snow introduced the Stalinist critique of Answer this morning, and I just wanted to know what you thought about that and the idea, what is the answer for the peace movement? There are a lot of other forces and organizations happening. The Answer group was great in convening this, and I'm reminded of Bell Hooks' quote, which I do quote a fair amount, which is that any coalition that doesn't include people you're uncomfortable with isn't broad enough. So something on that broader issue of populists on the air, and then something about what strategies the peace movement could do now, and how to deal with media, I guess, makes it a pertinent question right here. Mm. Thanks.
Thank you, Connor.
It's true. There was definitely a story about Jim Hightower referring to the mouse, I think.
Yeah, I think he's working for a rodent, was his comment, once the company worked for was bought by Disney back in 1995.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to see the same picture again with respect to the Donahue show on MSNBC. Whatever its fate may be, it doesn't look too rosy at the moment, and I think that's, again, being used as well. It just goes to show. I mean, my biggest complaint about all of this is what progressives get a chance of one. They get a one-shot chance to make it. The fact that the same stories come up and up, come over and over, Hightower failed or Donahue didn't succeed. These are the only guys who've ever been given a chance.
Yeah, and isn't it true also, Laura? I mean, you look at the so-called liberals on these sort of balance shows like Hannity and Combs, and the guys they have for liberals are people who make accountants look like the raciest guys on earth. I mean,
yeah,
they come up with these milquetoast dudes.
If we were going to look for the kind of graveyard of failed right-wing radio shows, I'm sure it's pretty full.
Yeah.
With respect to coverage of the anti-war coalition, I mean, I think it's interesting that there was a lot of debate in the fall in progressive circles about the role of sectarian left organizations like the Workers' World Party and the Answer Coalition. Organizing the rallies of October of last year, it wasn't until you saw these overwhelming numbers in Washington and New York this week that suddenly this became a story for the quote-unquote mainstream. As I say, I think perhaps Terry Gross on Fresh Air broke the national media barrier on this when she invited people from Answer, people from the National Council of Churches, and others into her studio to discuss, well, how do you all get along? Why do you all get along? Do you feel comfortable working with these sectarians? For those in the anti-war movement, this is old hat. There have always been coalitions that had, as our caller points out, members in them that, everyone doesn't agree in a coalition. What we're seeing now is a broadening of the movement, and at the very time that it's at its most broad so far, is when we start hearing about, sectarians in the midst. I don't think it's any coincidence.
There's also been a lot of stuff in the past week or two in the news media about the plummeting or at least declining popularity figures for President Bush due either to the war or the economy or some combination of the two, and that, he is not looking as infallible as he did just a couple months ago. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, this Bush, the tax plan should have really been called the Bye-Bye Bush plan, as far as I can see. De-tax the wealthy, deregulate industry. I mean, Bush said about his tax plan that he even wants to continue his push to reform the legal code to make it harder for consumers to hold wrongdoing companies to account. He wants to reward marriage and having babies. I mean, he's going to be proposing a federal cash payment at the door of every church before we know it. I mean, he's doing a lot for his traditional electoral base. But as Election Selection 2000 showed, you can't win elections with only the Republicans' traditional base. No matter how many religious right activists and corporate campaign financiers they've got at their backs, you can't fudge with all the Electoral College all the time. And although we all like to be, well, the media likes to ignore this, Bush came into office with a minority of the popular vote, no new electoral ground. He had carried only one northern state, New Hampshire, and that by only 8,000 votes. He has to start attracting support amongst, you know, people of color, amongst women, amongst people in suburban areas. If you remember that PowerPoint presentation on Karl Rove's CD disc that he lost in Lafayette Park, you remember they understood they needed to get immigrant voters, they needed to get women voters. Nothing that Bush is doing in office is going to, has so far helped him get those voters, and people are somewhat distracted by the war, but not so distracted that the largest budget shortfall in a century isn't hitting them back home. Bush's budget proposed no help to the states that are facing, you know, their worst shortfall in a century. People aren't stupid about that, and so his numbers are falling. I'm not surprised.
We're talking to Laura Flanders. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line one, Savoy, you're on the air with Laura Flanders.
Well, yes, I have two questions, and then I'll hang up. The first one is, I'm wondering, when did the word liberal become a curse word, which is basically the way it gets used in mainstream media and mainstream politics now, and even liberals don't want to be called liberals. They'd rather be called something else. That's the first. And the second one, just based on your previous comment a few minutes ago, I'm wondering why you think a president who wasn't elected in the first place is concerned about electoral politics. Why, since he made it to office without being elected in 2000, he has to worry about how he's going to get elected in 2004. So I'll hang up and I'll listen to your response. Thank you.
Well, I guess we could just go, we could become total cynics, and it's true that there were accounts of suppression of the vote efforts all around the country in 2002 in the midterms, but I don't think any president really wants to have to steal every election and suppress the vote everywhere all the time. So I think there are always electoral considerations going on. And from everything that we can read about Karl Rove and what happens in the Rove White House, they're very front and center of all of their concerns on a daily basis. So I think that's why. And with respect to liberal, you know, it's a tough word. Where I come from in the UK, liberal has a completely different meaning in the traditional European sense than it does in this country. I think it's a word that means, you know, different things to the different people that use them. That use it, and it's very hard to put your finger on, but it's one of those things you kind of know it when you see it. But I think increasingly people are less, you know, are embracing the term, or they're embracing more explicit terms, progressives or, you know, anti-militarists or, you know, You come up with it.
Okay.
There are more and more socialists out there, I think.
We're talking to Laura Flanders today in Media Matters. We've only got a few minutes left. Laura's joining us from her home in New York City. Very gracious of you to join us on a Sunday afternoon. Laura, what's your background? I mean, how did you get into media analysis? You mentioned you're from England originally, is that right?
Yeah, I grew up in the UK, and my first sort of experience of journalism was covering Northern Ireland, and I think it was there that I realized, you know, history really is written by the winners. And I had grown up all my life hearing about the Irish troubles and the Irish problem, and you travel 1 hour by a quick airplane, find yourself in a place where everyone talks about the English troubles and the English problem. It really, my whole understanding of what had happened there had been very one-sided in the English history books that tended to sort of play up the benevolent British role and play up the war-mongering, sort of apparently in the genes tendencies of the Irish. And when I actually started reporting from Northern Ireland, I realized there really were two sides to this story. And nothing could have been more important, it seemed to me, than to try to bring that kind of awareness to every story that we cover as we people living in at least ostensibly democracies try to make up our mind about policy options, we need to know what it is that we're looking at. And in this country, I started by working for the Pacifica Radio Network in New York on WBAI. I used to do a show called Undercurrents, Contrigate with Dennis Bernstein and Robert Knight, and we were looking at the Iran-Contra scandal. And again, it became very, very clear that for-profit media were not going to touch a story in its true depth that so threatened the establishment, and without the support and strengthening of alternative voices, we were going to be in big trouble.
You know, one of the areas you've been working on, I know recently, and writing about in your column, among other things, has been about the role of the women in the Bush administration. I mean, it seems that there's a, on one hand, you write about the attack on the right to choice that women have, that the Bush administration is leading, and on affirmative action. But on the other hand, there are people like Condoleezza Rice, Elaine Chao, who are prominent figures in the administration, Colin Powell for that matter. Is this a contradiction?
Well, no, I think it's all part of a careful strategy. I mean, I'm always reminded of that great story that Jill Abramson and Jane Mayer have in their book Strange Justice about Clarence Thomas, and they describe this scene where Clarence Thomas is winning a second term as the Republicans' man to head up the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission under Reagan. And it had been a really ugly fight to get him reconfirmed, and every civil rights organization, every feminist group imaginable had opposed his reconfirmation. Finally, they've won this big battle, and Brad Reynolds, who at the time was too radical to be confirmed as Attorney General, but who served as Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights under Ed Meese, he hosted the victory party for Clarence Thomas, and he says, according to the book, it's a proud moment for me to stand here because Clarence Thomas is the epitome of the right kind of affirmative action working the right way. You know, this was 1986, and I don't think we should be surprised by Republican cynicism around race and gender and diversity at this point. I think that the women in the administration are being very consciously used, again, to try to attract a very important part of the electorate. Will we see more of them as more and more of the Republicans' target voters get more and more uncomfortable with the state of their economy and the state of security at home? I think so. We're going to see a lot more of these professional, independent women who talk about Bush's commitment to equality and fairness, even as, in fact, they are, you know, a media-friendly face of an administration that, as we said at the beginning, couldn't be more radical in its pursuit of policies that, in fact, would deprive women of all sorts of rights, among others, and do away with the Bill of Rights, as we're already seeing.
Laura Flanders, I hear the band tuning up in the background. Before we go, are you working on any new books or articles people should keep their eyes open?
I am. I'm actually working on a book on the question of women in the Bush administration. It's called Bush Women, and it will be out next fall from Verso Press. And in the meantime, I urge people to tune in with their excellent questions to Working Assets Radio. You can listen any day, Monday through Friday, 10 to 11 West Coast time, or on the internet at workingassetsradio.com.
Thank you very much, Laura Flanders, for joining us today on Media Matters. We're going to have to get you back in the future. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. I want to thank Ben Scott. See you all 1 week from today.